I mean, in a sense, what I'm going to say is in counterpoint with Dennis's, a very expert, very scholarly paper. Dennis and I think very much alike, but in making presentations of this kind, everybody, inevitably constrained by time, leans towards simplification in one direction. I'm going to lean towards simplification in the other, because I'm going to argue that what we have really is a danger that we can overestimate the degree to which the concepts that we use in cross-national studies, the key concepts that we use, apply at different periods in time, the key concepts which are part of the discourse between different people with very different perspectives, really mean different things. They mean different things with respect to time, place, and events. And it's important to remember that in applying the kind of excellent theoretical frameworks which Dennis was presenting. I thought the best way for an old man to illuminate that is to talk about health, social care integration, and integration in multiple forms over the history in which I've been at the edge of the policy processes at the national level and down there, as Jerry was saying, and trying to manage something in the field and to evaluate it. So what I do in the presentation is to talk about integration, look at the sort of questions which I had in my title, which has now passed and probably a bit of a waste of time to go back to it, with respect to each of these periods. I've distinguished the periods really principally around epoch-making reports. Now, the test of an epoch-making report is the same as the test that we apply to ourselves as academics. Would the world have been different had we not done the job? Would other people have done exactly the same job? Would history have been any different? And the reports that I hang my presentation around are those reports in the British system which really did make a difference, stamped their individuality on the evolution of the system over periods of decades. So that's what it's about. And outcome, some hypotheses. This is not a great scholarly work. I didn't go back to original sources, as an historian should, etc. But you've got some hypotheses which are really relevant, not only to Britain, I think. It's the sort of questions that are useful to ask in the looking at the evolution of policy and practice and their consequences for outcomes, for users and caregivers, and for costs and the rest, and all the stakeholders in any country. First, that the constructions put on the concept of integration has indeed varied from time, across people, across places, within the UK. And done so in ways in which the construction in one period helped to determine the construction put on it, the meanings put on it, in the next. The meanings, I mean by the meanings, the hows, the whats, the whys, the whos, and all the factors, the concrete things, which really are the things that matter, and which are covered by the umbrella term integration. Secondly, that these constructions really shaped those outcomes, and at the end of each of these epochs, we had systems which was good in respects which reflected the constructions that had preceded that period. And what we have, therefore, is a sort of dependency in which the sequencing of things matter enormously to where one is at a point in time. And the sort of theoretical question I'd put to Dennis is, can one conceive of some paths, some sequences in the evolution of the way we use the general umbrella of integration and prioritize aspects of it, which will, in the longer run, produce healthier overall systems, more balanced overall systems, in terms of the outcomes they produce at the level of the individual, and the stakeholders like the people who finance things, than others. And that's the sort of question which it leads to. Now, there's another thing, that what I observe, what I hypothesize, is that what happened in Britain produced a system with a very high degree of something which organization theorists from sociology in the 1960s and 50s thought to be really absurdly over the top as an ambition to achieve. And that was a very high degree of what they called technological determinacy. Marvelous pair of phrases calculated to be completely unintelligible to everybody, but to sound great. The sort of thing politicians should use. What it means is very great clarity with respect to goals and their prioritization on the one hand, at the policy level, and a consistency in that right up and down the whole system. And from the top to the field, from the field to the top. Because, of course, one of the great things about the integration thing is this relationship between bottom-up priorities and logics, bottom-up imagination, and then top-down priorities and logics, and top-down imagination. Okay, so by the mid-90s, we had that, and also we had a second facet of the technological determinacy. We had statistically very reliable, reliable to and substantial predictability of the relationships between mixes of service inputs and their levels. Risk factors, which of course determine, are the biggest determinant of everything in practice down there. And outcomes, the outcomes of value in their own right, and to users and caregivers, and the outcomes for things like who pays what, and you know, costs and that sort of thing. Right. So that's those are the hypotheses. And I expect my 10 minutes is already up, actually. But now I move on to slide one, as to a period one.
Very quiet, Blit, in deference to the fact you have a fellow countryman from Wales.
Absolutely marvellous. Well, everybody's nice to have some support. So, okay, period one was post-war to the first of E.T. Putnam reports. Integration was always there. Integration, health and social care was always there. As something which was in the background. Simply not prioritized. Not prioritized because everybody's mind was elsewhere. You know, the context was that it was a hell of a job to get a national health service off the ground as a politically viable thing, and then to get it embedded, get people used to it, get all those people who had opposed it, cut the nail, the doctors and others, eventually to come to terms with it. And what they did was to buy them off in different ways. Consultants, they bought off, and Irene Bevan, a Welshman, bought off the consultants by what he described as stuffing their mouths with gold. He gave them absolute freedom to do what they wanted, and as long as they joined the NHS, they could do their private practice and earn their fortunes. The GPs, whom he recognized, really, had an element about the makeup of these primary care physicians, the family doctors, really of the sort of corner shopkeeper. They were running their own show, really quite a narrow perspective. That is not a very popular thing to say, I know. But an element of really terribly important to them, to run their own show, work through their own ethic, and do the good job by their criteria. Not perhaps the best metaphor, come to think of it, when I sort of qualify it. And so he bought them off by giving them virtual independence. They ran their own shows. There was a separate part of the NHS. They didn't really coordinate, not really subject to policy control. So, out of this came an implicit deal described by the most distinguished NHS policy analyst of the generation, Rudolf Klein, as being something which what the state did was to finance, regulate that financing a bit, but left it to the professions and to sort out the rest for themselves. There is no real central policy making in terms of prioritization of outcomes. No policy making, no policy monitoring with respect to the cost effectiveness of different kinds of things. Not even the creation of data systems. Now, occasionally, for a very short period, one would have a visionary minister. And that visionary minister was Enoch Powell, who had the idea, very much the ideas that we have today. The system as it was not sustainable and viable. It would have to go towards primary care, and that would have profound implications for the development of all sorts of services which are outside medicine and health, and the development of social care included. Out should go the big old hospitals, should be replaced by different concepts for secondary and tertiary care. It was called the Water Tower speech because he said, you know what, what we have to do is above all to change the assumptive worlds of the actors in the process. They must no longer be there defending their big Victorian edifices with their water towers. And they really had to think much more flexibly, and that meant thinking up from primary, thinking out to prevention, and thinking out to what became known as community care. Okay, let me move on quickly. Now, by now it's 15 minutes, I expect.
I've got them trained. It took 10 years, but I've got them trained.
Okay. So, what about the questions I post in the papers? The implicit deals I've talked about, uninspiring leadership I've talked about, other than Enoch Powell, no follow-through from Enoch Powell. There was also, among the reasons why it was bound to be like that, was that the institutional structures, one had these tiny local authorities providing social care. One had the chief officers of those local authorities were two. On the health side, they were the medical officers of health. They were aging. They were multi-purpose. There's an interesting paper in AJPH earlier in the year about the history of the ideational base, the assumptive base for the work of public health. In Britain between the wars. It showed how their old basis for their old logic, the basis of their old logic had been destroyed, and they were really very unsure about what they were doing. And what I was seeing when I was interviewing MOSH in 1960 was precisely that, degree of uncertainty. On the social care side, the people who were running the show in these tiny authorities were mainly former workhouse clerks. They'd entered as clerks in the workhouses and just come up competence to be the chief officers. There just wasn't a basis for very great visionary thinking. Right, phase one. Phase two. Seaboom to Griffiths. Labour administration came in 1964. Modernisation was its platform. On the social services, they had their guru, a chap called Richard Titmuss, a great politicker, marvellous operator. Richard Titmuss got together a group of people, and he was already extremely well connected with the Labour Party, of course, and the particular minister. And he got smuggled through, in a sense, the idea that they should establish this committee on personal and allied social services, Seaboom Committee. It was the composition of that committee, membership, reflected the assumptive worlds of the Titmussite people. It had Professor of Epidemiology, and most distinguished Professor of Epidemiology as a member. About 2 years ago, I had this invitation from him. I knew him vaguely, but didn't know him well. Come to lunch. And what he had to say was this. He wanted to tell me why it was that Seebohm came out with its conclusion that they should establish this separate entity, the big, powerful social care department at the local level, and have that administered separately right at the top of the policy process. What he said was that there was only one bit of evidence, hard evidence, that they had. And that came from the study of differences between local authority areas, which were controlled by where the social care was controlled by the medical officer of health, and local authority areas were controlled by these former workhouse clerks. The amazing finding was that the pattern of provision was much, much better in the ones run by the old workhouse clerks than the ones run by the MOSH, because the MOSH had, beneath their dignity, they'd left it to the current generation of workhouse clerks. These were not highly experienced and shrewd as the workhouse clerks. These were very low-level, people who were the most senior level there was in the management of the local health services. And a consequence of this, and adding, therefore, to the failure of the system at that time to have much potential, was that they also spent much, much less. They just did not raise the money from their authorities in competition with education, with competition with the other spending departments to do it. And this, said the professor of epidemiology, meant that he could not muster any support whatever for really seriously considering integration as part of the CBOM committee recommendations. The evidence was there. The Department of Health had the reputation for taking that as being a thing, and that's what happened. Right. 1 minute. Okay. Well, how's it go on? We did indeed change the meanings of integration as time went on. However, what we did in an interim stage in 1990 was to face an issue which I think many countries have not faced, and that is that the integration of radical integration, structural, and at all the Walter Lutz's levels, integration of health and social care, is something which requires vast preparation. It requires vast investments over very long periods of time, as indeed one of Walter's laws acknowledges. Therefore, it was argued by this chap, Sir Roy Griffiths, that we should make better sense initially to concentrate on integration within social care than to go immediately into profound structural integration. And if it didn't work, we could come back to it subsequently. And that's what the government did. And now, in the process of doing that, it really transformed the world from technological complete indeterminacy. I was lucky enough to be able to do a before-after study of this. Multi-system study, systems unit analysis, an area system, and in the mid-80s, before the Griffiths report, no sign whatever of this technological determinacy. After that, enormous impacts of the services on outcomes of value in their own right. Predictable ones, very clear relationships between risk factors, mixes and levels of services, and these outcomes. Now, however, it did nothing whatever, nothing much about integrating health and social care. A new Labour Party, a new modernising administration came in. They had a new platform which had to completely transform the world, and that would, of course, part of that would have to be to transform the health social care world. And they went extremely hard for integration. What are we finding? Well, we're finding there is evidence that this proposition that we're in a highly technologically determinate world, if one wants to improve in one way, one has to pay the price in by losses in other ways. We've got some evidence. This evidence is now accumulating in several ways. That if we want to take on new models, like what we call community matrons, nurse-led models, which are aimed at people who would be at high risk of emergency entry, which using the kind of formula which Jerry used, and applying them in Britain, that is at the expense of people targeted by social care. Now, it so happens, very dangerous, slipshod thinking, in which the concept of integration was not properly decomposed, was not properly deconstructed, taken to pieces. It's exactly what it means and related to its context. It didn't work. It didn't work because we've got very elaborate systems of primary care. We've got a very strongly coordinated system in some senses before we start. May not have the structural things, but anyway, that's it. Okay, finish. Thank you very much.
Don't leave Dr. Davies, please. Glenn has been one of our pioneers. He's an international leader in this field. It's his intellect and his practicality that make a difference. And he's been at the bottom level, and he's been at the ministerial level. And it takes a certain personality to be able to do both well, and Glenn hasn't. So, are there any questions for Dr. Davies? Yes, Dr. Raven.
Par excellence, much greater power held by the central government. I mean, Britain, when they have a majority and determination and leadership, and this sort of determination to impose a new vision right across social policy and indeed the whole of society around a platform, much more so than USA, France. You think of France as being highly centralized. It isn't, as compared with Britain. The real power is just enormous. And it's the power to use legitimate but also illegitimate means to achieve change. It's the power to bully. It's the power to make to have sort of hidden rewards and sanctions to make the system conform. And these have been used very fully in the present administration, and the effects have been very substantial. At the field level, most, more than half of the teams now are cross-health social care divide. They're multidisciplinary. A substantial minority, approaching a half, of authorities at the local level, the politically accountable area level, are now joint between health and social care. It's been very significant. But, quantitatively, US is out on its own. The other great group of states, large number of states, are those you associate with national insurance funding. They're national insurance funding primarily because they're corporate in their political structures. If you're corporate in your political structures, you have so many divided forms of responsibility and accountability, so many pockets for resistance, that reforms are much, much slower. And that's partly why we have another national insurance.
Thanks, Glenn. But I think, David, the answer to your question is partly in what Kathy did. Oregon is 90% institutional, 10% home and community-based. The issue is, what was Oregon in 1975? Is it because they've had a much relatively younger population that they started that way, or were they like the rest of the U.S. that was 95-5? If Oregon's moved from 5 to 10% in terms of their expenditure in 30 years, that's progress. And that's the progress that we can see. In the absence of any kind of total dictatorial thing, we don't know, because I don't know where Oregon started. I don't know if Oregon's moved ahead or just stayed at the same place they were in 1975 when I met Dick Ladd, see? And because we don't have numbers like that. And I think next year, what we're going to emphasize we're going to have another one, and we're going to, international, we're going to emphasize outcomes. We're going to emphasize financial outcomes, and we're over time, and we're going to ask people to come up with what these proportions were over time. Now, we know Dr. Akimoto in Japan has this huge institutional issue with ostensibly hospital beds. I'm not sure that that they're much in worse shape than we are in the U.S. because remember, we only spend 5%, and I don't know whether they have the numbers to say they have to send something on this home and community care. So I don't think that they're any worse than we are. I don't think we're any better than they are. I don't know how far Oregon might be ahead of us. Other countries will have to look and see if we can get some measure of outcomes, financial. The other outcome that nobody talks about, are the patients any better off? I mean, nobody really mentioned that. I mean, I think that's a key outcome. Do we improve people's not only quality of life, do we improve their function, their morbidity, and mortality? And that's what this is all about. So, thank you. Dennis, we're over our time. I'd like to accommodate you, but you're going to have to come to San Diego next year. So. Thank you. Let's give a round of applause for all the speakers.